We'll be talking about fairy tales in the modern world this hour with a translator who brought them there. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the discussion, is 800-838-3760 or email us jx@jeffnet.org. Once upon a time, bards sang of farts and fetching maidens, of wicked witches and zombie princes. And when fairy tales were first born, happy endings had little to do with them. They were usually macabre, mixing lofty metaphors and social criticism with lowbrow innuendos, potty humor, and violence. One early writer of recorded fairy tales was Giambattista Basile, an Italian courtier of the 17th century. His tales are back in action thanks to a recent translation by our guest today. She tackled Basile's The Tale of Tales, or Lo Conto delle Conti, and we'll ask our guest to do the Italian translating from here on out, but she worked with the original Neapolitan dialect to bring this text into its modern form. She's an associate professor of French and Italian at Dartmouth College and joins us now by phone. Nancy Canepa, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be there.
So, well, we're very thrilled to have you, and it was a joy to read your translation. At first,
Thank
I thought,
you.
You know, this is pretty esoteric stuff. We're going back to 17th century Naples, and the full title of the text is The Tale of Tales, or Entertainment for Little Ones.
Yes.
Were little ones really the intended audience here?
No. Short answer. That's a very tongue-in-cheek subtitle, I think. Children's literature as a category didn't really exist in the 17th century.
Uh-huh.
That's more of a 19th century invention. Children could be part of the audience for orally told tales, but they were certainly not the only audience. And you know from having read even just some of Basile's tales that the way he writes is so sophisticated, so flowery. He uses so much metaphor that these are tales that I don't think would have been much interest to children in terms of hearing them read or reading them themselves. So his audience is definitely an adult, very sophisticated, literate, courtly audience, which was kind of the ambient that he worked and lived in.
Yeah, let's talk more about Basile's life and times. He was a soldier of fortune at one point, and he was also a courtier. What are those job titles? They don't really hold much resonance in our world today. What do they mean?
Well, being a courtier was actually a pretty common occupation for literary people, mostly men, actually, the idea of a writer that we have today as someone who kind of independently looks for publishers and agents and so forth didn't really exist. In order to be able to work as a writer, you generally had to have some kind of patron who was whose auspices you were kind of working under. And so a courtier was someone who would work in a court, write correspondence for the lord for whom he served, write literary pieces for occasions such as weddings and other festivities of the family that he was serving with. And then also he would have time, hopefully, for some of his own work. But you did kind of need that kind of protection in order to carry on as a writer in Basile's time.
So patronage was protective, perhaps necessary, but did Basile get burned out on that? I'm thinking of a line I read in the introduction to your translation of his Tale of Tales, and it said, "It would be a good idea never to publish anything, but if this mistake really has to be made, my view is that the dedication should be to the wind, you know, not to Prince so-and-so." He seems a little bitter there. Was that the case?
I think he was. Yeah, that came from a letter that he actually wrote in dialect that prefaced another work in dialect by one of his fellow Neapolitans. And although the accounts that we have of him as a person seem to say that he was a very good-natured, kind of relaxed, nice kind of guy, it does seem from things like that letter and other remarks that he did get kind of burnt out. And he served in a remarkably high number of different places in the south of Italy, in Venice. He went to Crete, actually, when he was serving a lord in Venice. But especially in the last decades of his life, he moved from place to place in the south of Italy, where he was awarded governorships, you know, administrative posts, which, on the one hand, probably put him into contact with oral storytelling that he then kind of, you know, recycled into his tales. But on the other hand, he did have kind of intense administrative responsibilities, and so it did take away from the time that he could dedicate to what he loved most.
And these tales told in The Tale of Tales, they were not published during his lifetime. They were published by his sister a couple of years after he dies in 1634. Did he intend for them ever to be written down and published?
I think he probably did, but he probably was also in the process of still revising them when he died. He died rather suddenly after Mount Vesuvius erupted in 1631, and a terrible flu epidemic followed, and he was one of the victims of that epidemic. So,
a lot more to talk about here on the topic of Jean-Baptiste Basile, today's author. He's already dead, conversationally speaking. The translator, Nancy Canepa, joins us to talk about The Tale of Tales and bringing it into this century from the 17th Neapolitan dialect that it was written in. I'm Emily Curitan. This is the Jefferson Exchange. We hope you will join our discussion. Phone number and email address are on the way after a very short break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with today's guest, Nancy Canepa, translator and associate professor of French and Italian at Dartmouth College. We're talking about her work bringing The Tale of Tales by Jean-Baptiste Basile into our age. It is a collection of rather gruesome fairy tales, first written in 17th century Naples. This conversation, like any conversation on the Exchange, wouldn't be complete without you. Phone number 800-838-3760, or you can email us, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Nancy, we were just talking about how Basile managed to survive Vesuvius and then got by the flu in about 1632.
Mm-hmm.
His sister publishes, she's a diva of the time, and she publishes The Tale of Tales a couple of years after his death. And like so many epic fairy tales, this one is also driven by a despotic figure. Can you lay the frame tale, the one that sets up all the other tales in this work, put that in a nutshell for us?
So the frame tale, and this is not always the case with frame tales, is of the same genre as the whole book, that is a fairy tale. And it tells of a princess who never laughed, which is a common folkloric motif. And her father, as one of his attempts to get her to laugh, constructs a fountain of oil in front of the royal palace, hoping that when all of the poor folk of the town come to fill their jars with oil, they'll slip and slide and perform silly antics that will make her laugh. And that actually initially does not happen. What does happen is that an old woman comes and is one of the people filling her jar with oil, and a court page who's sitting up in the palace window throws a rock and breaks her jar, and the old woman bursts out in a string of insults at this court page for having hit her jar with a rock, to which he responds with more insults, to which she responds by pulling up her skirt and showing the royal audience the bushy scene on her stage, as Basile puts it. And that finally makes the princess laugh. She laughs, and then the old woman, who it's not clear what her status is at the beginning of the scene, she seems just like a Neapolitan member of the lower classes in Naples. By the end of the scene, she curses the princess to go off and never be able to stop traveling until she finds a prince sleeping at a fountain, who she will have to wake by shedding two urns full of tears. So she seems almost like a witch figure at the end of that scene. And so the princess, her name is Zodza, departs on her mission to do that. She finds the prince sleeping by the fountain. She starts crying, and she has almost filled her two urns of tears when she falls asleep. And at that point, a black slave, who has been watching her from behind a tree, comes and sheds the last few tears needed to fill up the urns, and the prince wakes, thinks the slave is his destined bride, and goes off and marries her. When Zodza, the princess, wakes up, she takes off immediately for the prince's kingdom, where she installs herself in a palace right in front of his. And on her way to get there, she had encountered a number of fairies who had given her magic objects that would produce, for example, a golden chick that sang and danced marvelously, and things like that. And so she kind of exposes these objects on her windowsill, where the prince and his new wife, who is now pregnant, can see them, and the pregnant wife wants to have each of these objects that she sees.
Right.
So in each case, the prince goes over to the disguised princess and offers her money for them, to which she refuses, saying, "I'll just give them to you." And anyway, the last object is one that instills in the pregnant slave the irrepressible desire to hear tales. And at that, the prince calls for a competition in the city to see who the best tale tellers are. The best tale tellers end up being 10 grotesque old hags who, however, have the sharpest wit and tongues of all of the tellers. And they all gather around the fountain in the prince's courtyard, and for 5 days, they're 10 tale tellers, for 5 days, each of the 10 tale tellers tells a tale. And this is a very urgent kind of thing, because the pregnant slave had said, "If I don't hear tales, I feel that my baby isn't going to survive."
Little Georgie Kill is what she says, right?
Yeah,
how you translate
yeah.
it. It's not just that her baby won't survive, it's that
she's going to murder. Yeah,
yeah.
Right, right.
Uh-huh.
So as often is the case with frame tales and the tales that are told as a result of them, I'm thinking of the Arabian Nights, for example. This
right.
is a really life and death situation.
Uh-huh.
Tales have to be told in order to guarantee the life of someone, in this case, the unborn baby.
Right.
And so the tales are told for the 5 days. But at the very end of the fifth day, the 10th tale teller is sick, and the original princess from the frame tale, who is part of the tale telling audience, steps in as for the sick tale teller and tells her own story, the story of the frame tale, which of course unmasks the slave's deceit, who at that point is buried up to her head, still pregnant, and the princess Zodza of the frame tale regains her rightful place as the wife of the prince.
You know, there's a lot of uncomfortable stuff in these
Absolutely.
Tales, and I wonder, was it uncomfortable for people back then, or were they just like, ha ha, ugly women, evil slaves, ha ha, like?
Yeah, they weren't as uncomfortable as we are today.
Uh-huh.
There, you know, the slave, black slaves, and a black slave could actually mean a Turkish slave, for example, or a North African slave. There were a lot of slaves around in the southern Mediterranean, and they often did appear in other sorts of literary genres as well, theater, for example. And they wouldn't have caused people to raise an eyebrow as much as we do today.
We're talking with Nancy Canepa about the Tale of Tales, born in 17th century Naples. It is an example of early recorded fairy tales penned by Jean-Baptiste Basile, also long dead, but his work lives on thanks to Canepa's recent English translation. Join the discussion, 800-838-3760. Or write email jx@jeffnet.org. And Nancy, speaking of the role of slaves, reading through the text, there's a lot of reference to being black or being darker. Are darker people, black people, always depicted negatively in these tales?
I would say yes.
And, and Jews as well?
Yes, there aren't as many references to Jews. They're more kind of aside, but when they are present, they're generally negative. Yep. Negative, which again would not have raised too much an eyebrow at Basile's time. One other thing regarding the kind of black and white dichotomy is that that aligns quite well with dichotomies in general, moral dichotomies, good and bad, obedient and disobedient, that are very much part of the landscape of fairy tales. Basile's not as much. Basile kind of stretches the limits of that, very clear black and white world.
One of my questions here is, are these fables, are there morals to these stories? I'm thinking particularly of one where a king, he fattens up a flea with his own blood till it's huge, mm-hmm. and then he skins it and has like a guessing game to see who can figure out what animal the skin came from, mm-hmm. and whoever guesses correctly gets to marry his daughter. Mm-hmm. Like, what's the moral of that kind of a story?
It's interesting, first of all, that there are explicit morals at the end of these tales in the form of little proverbial phrases, which, interestingly, often don't fit the tale at all. For example, I'm just looking at the flea, the fifth tale of the first day. So the moral at the very end there is, how big a mistake is made by those who go looking for wolves' eggs and 15 teethed cones. Well, that actually kind of applies, and there's a note. There are many notes in this edition, as you saw. And anyway, the gist of it is that those who go looking for things that they shouldn't be looking for or trying to do, such as fattening up this flea to grotesque proportions, end up badly. And, I mean, I think the kind of lesson of that tale is what the king tries to do is, first of all, to go against nature, fattening up this flea until it's the size of a castrated sheep. I think Basile
very
says.
Specific, yes.
And when you try to do things like that, the consequences are disastrous. His daughter ends up married to an ogre because he's the one who guesses that the skin that the king has on display is, in fact, from an ogre. And she eventually is rescued and does not have to live her life with the ogre. But the father, at the end, is very repentant for what he did. And, his initial foolish, irresponsible action sets off this whole chain of events that proves to be very negative. And speaking about irresponsible kings, like this one, he is a king who seems to have nothing better to do than to fatten up fleas and display mm-hmm. their, grotesquely oversized skins. He's one of many, many kings who seem totally distracted from what should be their kingly duties of, reigning in a just and courageous way. And that's kind of an interesting aspect of this whole collection, too. There are so many inept kings who, if we didn't learn that they were kings at the beginning of the tales, we might think that they were just, are nosy or kind of half eccentric or crazy next door neighbor.
And was that hazardous for the author Jean-Baptiste Basile, who was a courtier and very much operated and wrote and created art at the behest of patrons like princes and kings? So did he face blowback by making them look stupid in these tales?
No, I don't think really, because one, they were the genre that he is engaging with is the fairy tale, the literary fairy tale. He's the first to publish a collection of literary fairy tales in Europe. So it's this genre which is still kind of between the oral and literary, and because of that is not quite taken seriously as much as tragedy or even a comedy or an epic poem or other more established genres, where it could be perhaps a little bit more risky to portray rulers in this case like that. He's also writing in Neapolitan dialect, which is a non-standard language. The language at the time, that the literary language of Italy at the time that he was writing, was the literary language of Dante, Petrarch, Boccaccio, the great, you know, fathers of the Italian tradition.
Right.
And that was Tuscan, originally based on the Tuscan dialect. All three of those authors came from Tuscany. It was starting to be called Italian at this time as well. So he is, you know, consciously choosing to write in another language that does have some literary tradition at this point, but until he and several other extremely talented Neapolitan writers get to it, it's not really a fully developed literary language.
Well, as a language, who spoke this dialect that he wrote in for these tales? As you were saying, they were more meant for courtly conversation than the sort of the tombs of books or more elevated literature. Who spoke the Neapolitan dialect that the Tale of Tales is written in, and in what circumstances?
The people of Naples spoke it as their first language.
I see.
Everyone in Italy at this point really spoke a local dialect as their first language.
Hmm.
You know, literary Italian was kind of an acquired lingua franca, almost, in the context of Italy. That was used for literature and, you know, used for speaking too, but really everyone spoke their dialect. And that means not only people of, you know, lower classes, but really everyone. So Naples at this point in time was, a huge metropolis and cultural center, probably in Europe, second only to Paris. So in Naples itself, there was a rather large public of people who could understand Neapolitan. Also, Neapolitan, as well as other dialects, had been used, excuse me, on the stage, for example, in the Commedia dell'arte form of theater, and kind of in more standard theater as well, as the language that was put in the mouth of, you know, certain types of characters. So, other Italians kind of had something of an ear for it, although if they had been read aloud one of Basile's tales, they wouldn't necessarily have understood all of it.
So as a translator dealing with a 500-year-old text written in a somewhat obscure dialect, and your job is to consider the linguistic and cultural strata of every single word. Meanwhile, this text is rife with puns and wordplay and obscenity, which are definition of changes pretty regularly. How do you deal with all that and decide which phrases need to be literal and which ones need to be translated into more modern turns of phrase?
Well, it wasn't an easy job. It wasn't a short job.
How long did it take you?
Well, you know, with my other obligations, teaching and so forth, it took probably about 10 years. Again, not you know, 24 hours or 8 hours, even a day of working exclusively on this. But it was a big project, precisely because of all of the, you know, reasons that you just gave. Basile's version of the Neapolitan dialect is also a very original version. So the language of his book is not really the language that exactly the language that Neapolitans on the street or in the courts even would have been speaking. He writes a lot in his activity as a man of letters and courtier in Italian as well. Actually, he writes a lot more in Italian than he does in Neapolitan. He's very, very much aware of the Italian literary tradition, of its great authors, of you know, the conventions, the rhetoric, and so forth. And he incorporates all of this in his Neapolitan. So Italo Calvino, who's another great 20th century writer of fairy tales in Italy, called him an odd Mediterranean Shakespeare. And I think that's a wonderful definition.
Why odd?
Well, odd because it is just such a disorienting and jarring experience, I think. I'm assuming that you found this at some points, to read Basile because of his extravagant wordplay, because mm-hmm. of his takes on fairy tales that on the one hand are very familiar to us. You know, in Basile we have the first literary versions of Cinderella, Rapunzel, Sleeping Beauty, and so forth. But at the same time, even plot-wise, he twists them in very interesting and sometimes disturbing ways.
We are talking with Nancy Canepa about her translation of The Tale of Tales, or Entertainment for Little Ones, by Jean-Baptiste Basile. Not really for children. A lot of macabre, odd details in these stories. It is the first integral collection of fairy tales published in Europe, and we'll be talking more about it on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Emily Curitan, and we will be back with your phone calls and emails on the other side of a short break. It's 8:41. Actually, it's 9:41. And we are back on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Emily Curitan, talking today with Nancy Canepa, translator of The Tale of Tales. We're talking about fairy tales today, going way back in time, and also considering their modern resonance. We want to hear from you. Phone number is 800-838-3760, or email us jx@jeffnet.org. The Jefferson Exchange is also on Facebook, easy to find and like there, or you can follow us on Twitter @JeffExchange. So, Nancy, we're just talking about the process, this 10-year process for you of grappling with this text and bringing it into modern English. How did Jean-Baptiste Basile's Tale of Tales change for you over time as you worked on it? Like the 100th time you read The Old Woman Who Was Skinned compared to the first?
Well, previously to the translation, I had written a book on this collection, too. And so, you know, when you write a book on another book, you generally think of yourself as a pretty good and close reader of that book. But I have to say, and I'm not the first to talk about translation in this way, that it wasn't really until I translated Basile that I felt that I had really, really read the book. Just kind of having to deconstruct his elaborate descriptions and metaphors, and then to consider why he might have chosen, you know, a metaphor that refers to the realm of banking as opposed to the realm of, fishing or something like that, and the resonances that those choices have for the rest of the text, just made me read it in a much deeper way than I had thought was possible, that I had read it previously.
And was it metaphor that really sort of changed for you? I'm thinking of times when, like, for example, what it means to have no hairs on your tongue. I feel like mm-hmm. today we might say they had a silver tongue, or we can get what it means by context, but in a lot of cases, as the translator, you seem to have chosen to use the literal words that the author put in there and let us work from context. How did you make those calls?
Well, in general, I did tend to embrace kind of a more foreignizing translation, which is a strategy where, as a translator, I try to urge my reader to, you know, confront the original text on its own terms in my translation, as much as that was possible, without, of course, alienating them completely. And I did that because reading Basile in Neapolitan today or in Italian today, and I think even, you know, hearing his tales in Neapolitan at his own time would have been a somewhat disorienting experience because of what I mentioned before, this odd mix of kind of high and low registers.
Right.
He has so much material taken from proverbs, from sayings, a lot of which are very local, are very very much tied to the city of Naples and its customs and traditions and, you know, culinary habits and everything. And so I wanted to preserve that in my translation, even when it did mean perhaps not choosing the easy equivalent of a proverb, which uses, however, very different words. That's one of the reasons for the very copious notes. I really feel that Basile's use of metaphors and all of this, you know, what you could think of as extraneous material, I don't think it's extraneous material, but you could say, you know, with regard to the plot, it's just extra. But I think all of that material tells another tale or set of tales in itself, and that is the story of daily life in 17th century Naples. And that's really, really interesting in a very different way from how the fairy tales are interesting.
Right. It's almost like a whole, like, as you're saying, a tale within the tale of tales. Your footnotes are exhaustive and incredibly interesting, a historical text in and of themselves. I get the sense that you've put a lot of work into helping us not lose things in translation, to really feel and be, to an extent, in 17th century Naples as we read this somewhat disorienting and oftentimes gruesome text. But, Nancy, what did get lost in translation? What could you just not pack into those footnotes or into the words you chose to translate?
I think just, you know, I think that Basile's love for language and just his kind of joyful playfulness sometimes comes out. But I don't really think that any translation could completely express that joy. That joy in a language that he is kind of inventing as he writes it. He's not inventing Neapolitan dialect, but he's inventing this very evolved literary form of Neapolitan. As I said before, he and a number of other writers writing in that same period, the first 50 years of the 17th century, are really bringing Neapolitan up to, a status as literary language, a status that it hadn't quite had to the same degree before. And that joy of discovering things in a new language is hard, just by nature of that, hard to replicate in a language, in any language that is not, you know, new in that same way.
And what kinds of scenes or tales did you see that joy most potently in evidence?
Well, I think more so than in tales, it's in descriptions. You have seen...
What about the insults? Sorry to interrupt, but I found them spectacular. So
the insults?
Yes.
I can read from that first scene in the frame tale, if you like, where the...
I'm a little bit afraid because there are some obscenities in there, but I would love for you to read.
Okay.
and hopefully we don't need our 10-second delay. Go right ahead, Nancy. Let's hear some spectacular insults from Jean-Baptiste Basile's The Tale of Tales. This is the frame tale, which sets up the rest of the story sort of told under fear of dire punishment.
So, after the old woman's jar has been broken by this rock thrown by the court page, the old woman, now I'm reading, the old woman who had no hairs on her tongue and let no one ride on her back, turned to the page and began to say, "Ah, you worthless diaper ass, hangman's noose, bastard mule. Look, even fleas can cough now. Go on, may paralysis seize you. May your mother get bad news. May you not live to see the 1st of May. Go on, may you be thrust by a Catalan lance or torn apart by ropes so that no blood will be wasted. May you suffer 1,000 ills and then some with winds in your sails. May your seed be lost. Scoundrel, beggar, son of a taxed woman, rogue."
I'm getting nervous here, Nancy. I'm going to cut you off there because we have already lost our delay due to the colorful nature of many of those insults.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. So, I mean, for you, when you're translating this, are you just like giddy, or do you sometimes hold your head in your hands? Like, how can I possibly capture the sort of the depth of obscenity here?
Well, both, actually. And the biggest problems were, in fact, with lists of insults like this. But also with lists, you know, there are other points in the book when he, and again, it's kind of extraneous to what's actually happening in some cases, when he'll have long lists of dishes, for example, you know, foods, or in one, types of fish. I just remember with the fish really having my head in my hands, because a lot of those fish are fish that don't even exist outside of the Mediterranean. So how to translate them? But then, you know, when you do kind of come to some sort of solution and you feel that it sounds okay or even good, those are nice moments too.
We're talking about the joy in the language of Jean-Baptiste Basile. He's the author of The Tale of Tales, and he is very, very dead since 1632. He was born near Naples, Italy, and was an accomplished poet, courtier, and writer of this first, one of the first published collections of fairy tales in Europe. A translator of it is Nancy Canepa. She's our guest today. And Nancy, thinking of these specific tales, we've talked about insults, and I'm gonna go ahead and venture into some other fraught terrain here, because the sex scenes in these stories, which the Tale of Tales is subtitled "Entertainment for Little Ones," mm-hmm. Jefferson Exchange does not endorse this book for children unless you know, you really wanna open their minds in a particular way, but. Can we talk about the sex scenes some more? I'm thinking, again, the old woman who was skinned just sort of always rises to the top for me here. The part where she's like gathering up her wrinkles and pulling them in a knot behind her back, sort of like a store mannequin in a too big dress in order to seduce yet another stupid king. Is that typical of sex scenes in the Tale of Tales?
That's really one of the most grotesque sex scenes. There are not the only sex scene, and there are some more, you know, rather tender ones as well. But that definitely is, you know, surpasses them all in terms of grotesqueness. Yeah, so the context is that there is an old woman, two old sisters, very old sisters, who live in this kind of odd spatial arrangement in a ground floor room under the balcony of a king, another one of these kings who doesn't seem to have anything better to do than to, you know, wonder about these neighbors because they're always complaining about being bruised by a feather that has fallen down from his balcony and so forth. Anyway, he finally convinces one of them to visit him in his bedroom, and she, of course, makes him promise that she will do it in the dark, only in the dark. And so the scene that you mentioned, where before going to him in his bedroom, she gathers up all her wrinkles, smooths back all the wrinkles on her body and gathers them behind her shoulders in a knot, which she tied tightly with a piece of twine. And so then she goes into the king's bedroom, and the king immediately suspects that something is not right, mostly because of the smell. But he kind of plows forth, pretending not to notice, he plows forth anyway. And it's only after the act that he gets a light and sees who he's actually been in bed with, at which point he throws her out of the window.
Right. Well, and this tale, like so many of them, part of the reason I brought up sex scenes is, to my 21st century eyes, you know, a lot of these stories, they've got some racially motivated hate, they've got anti-Semitism, they've got good old fashioned misogyny in mm-hmm. spades. So why translate them? Why carry on this tradition?
These are, in many cases, not in the case of the old woman who is skinned, but as I said before, we have many of the first literary versions of the classic tale types, you know, from Cinderella to Hansel and Gretel to Rapunzel to Sleeping Beauty and so forth.
Rapunzel, yeah.
Yeah, Rapunzel as well, and many others that perhaps aren't as well known, but whose motifs, you know, are familiar when you read them. This book was, although it's not kind of on the modern reader's radar, hopefully it will be more now, but really hasn't been, it was it had a great influence on the Brothers Grimm, for example, who actually intended to translate the whole thing themselves and then ended up not being able to do that. The Charles Perrault, who wrote the Mother Goose Tales at the end of the 17th century, he and a group of women fairy tale writers who were part of that same movement were very much influenced by Basile, whom they knew. This is kind of where the literary tradition of the fairy tale, of the literary fairy tale, begins in Europe. There's another writer called Straparola who inserts a few fairy tales in a novella collection of his in the 16th century. But Basile's collection is really, a milestone in the fairy tale tradition. And Basile is so playful and kind of deconstructing of every possible moral category and every possible platitude that even what appear to be and what are, slurs on all of the categories that you mentioned.
Every human. I mean, no one is safe.
No one is safe. And that is another, I'm glad you mentioned his humanity, because that is another aspect of this collection that really hits you in the face.
Well, Nancy, we've got about a minute or less than a minute, just a few seconds left here. Do you have a favorite insult? I'm just riding this one hard because I'm curious.
A favorite insult? I probably do, but I don't think I can say it. It's probably the continuation of that exchange in the frame tale, which is so long and so colorful.
Yeah.
You could just kind of imagine it.
People can get the uncensored version of The Tale of Tales, written by Jean-Baptiste Basile in 16-something. He died in 1632, translated by Nancy Canepa, our guest today. Thank you so much for being here, Nancy.
Oh, thank you for having me.